We're here at WBAI, and we've asked several outstanding jazz musicians in the field to come up here and discuss various problems, social problems, economic problems, which have occurred throughout the scene here in New York City. We'd like to get into the discussion right away, and the first question I'm going to throw at you people, what do you think about the present employment scene here in New York City? Would you take it up, please, George?
Well, there is no employment scene because no one is working except the groups who have traditionally worked, and they are having a very difficult time of it. One jazz club closed, the Jazz Gallery, so the employment scene is practically zero in New York City.
Could you elaborate on that? Could you go a little further? Why the scene is dead? Why these musicians are not getting hired?
I think it's a matter of oversaturation of the groups that have been popular. I mean, as a fan, I'm particularly tired of hearing the same old groups. It's also a matter of the emotional tie-in between the people who own the clubs, the bookers, with these groups who at one time probably made money for them. And it's not just it's a case of not being very perceptive on the part of the bookers and the club owners. Well, they aren't really noted for being perceptive people, you know, so they can only cling to something that has worked for them in the past. I'm sure they're just as befuddled as anyone else. But and it's also a reluctance to hire people who are active in producing music that I feel has quite a bit more of a wide audience than it's given credit for. And music that's produced by some of these gentlemen at the table here today, and it's a reluctance on the part of the club owners and the bookers and the recording companies to recognize this music. And but they, as I said before, they've never been very as a group, they haven't been particularly courageous or perceptive people.
How has the record clubs and also the vast communication media such as television and radio, how responsive have they been, Gunther?
Well, not enough, certainly. Every once in a while there seem to be a few brave souls which try in their own way. Sometimes they're, even with the best of intentions, a little bit befuddled about what they're doing, but they at least try. But these brave souls are in such a minority, and they are so outswamped and outflanked by all the rank commercialism that you know exists in these media, because these media are so tied to the dollar and to the whole economic spiral, that what little they've tried to do has really been of such negligible impact that it has not affected, for example, anybody at this table. I mean, again, the effect, as George said, has been nil in terms of any, you know, beneficial effects for composers or musicians who are really trying to do something original or creative or innovational. I think whether it be nightclubs or whether it be recording companies or whether it be television stations, as long as you have the kind of economic and moral attitude that you have prevalent in this country, and which seems to be on the increase all the time, which is solely geared to, or almost solely and exclusively geared to, making more and more money easier, then these other values, such as artistic or aesthetic values, simply don't have much of a chance. And the artist, is, as far as I can see, it simply has to, I don't know whether he has to, but at the present time I don't know many solutions to this except to just suffer through it and believe in yourself and have, unfortunately there are always other people that do believe in you as well, and go it alone, so to speak. I don't expect much help from these people, frankly.
You don't?
No.
Arnett, you've had a certain amount of success in the last 2 or 3 years, or 2 years, should we say. And you've had certain records released by various record companies, which I won't mention here at the present moment. Do you find this to be true? Have you been stifled in any way by the A&R man, or the record company itself, as far as your creative abilities are concerned?
Well, it's hard to say, because it's hard to define what is known as creative ability, I guess. But as far as recording for economical purposes, I guess creative ability is considered a thing that isn't as active as economic ability. And I think that to record music for creative ability, if that is the problem, why there's less work or less money made, because the person is honestly trying to do something without a economical purpose as being the sole reason why they're doing something. But I don't really think their creative ability is as active in any industry where that it has to create an economical purpose for maybe a group of people or a person or maybe a organization. But I really couldn't comment on about the aspect of the business. I guess the recording company being, as you would say, making me successful or rich or any of those things, because I haven't had any of an experience in any of those things yet.
I see. Cecil, at the present moment, I don't know if you are employed or not.
I am. Yes,
he's employed. Where?
Take Three.
Oh, Take Three. You haven't been on the scene for a while, as far as a few people are concerned, as far as the big clubs.
Last time I worked was in November.
At a club. I believe that was a five-spot cafe, wasn't it?
Yes.
I spoke to the manager one time about your appearing there. I believe you were trying to get back there one time. And he mentioned the fact that you played too long. I can see why he has a business to take care of. And if you do play for a specific amount of time, people don't buy as much drinks, and he doesn't bring in as much money. I can see him as a club owner stating the fact that he wouldn't want you to come back at that particular moment unless you decided you would play within a certain limit of time.
Well, I suppose what you're talking about are the realities. The realities are, as George and Gunther have said before, that we live in a country where art is not the thing, you know. Like, if you're an artist, then you take on the responsibility of being an artist, which does, in a sense, preclude you being a machine, which means that you, you know, time it. You're going to play 30 minutes, or you're going to play 15 minutes. I don't know what the answer is.
I think what Cecil means in the relationship of a person playing for the sake of being an artist has a lot to do with who's actually listening to what he's playing. I mean, if I've seen successful, say, economical musicians play for hours one tune, and I've never seen a club owner go up to them and tell them to stop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in such case, where I don't see why any person should be partial to one group of players or anyone else, if the
do you find that various club owners are partial?
Well, I think club owners are partial, you know, from buying liquor to charging over prices, are either underpaying. I mean, club owners to me seems to definite be in the limelight of creating an economical purpose to stay in business, which is they are right. But when they play the music too without having the instrument in their hand, just from their mind to what they think is creating the money or stopping the money from coming in, I think they get that confused with what the person is doing more than how the people are appreciating what they are doing.
And do you agree with that?
Well, I think
I
think what Arnett hinted at is something that we do have to take into consideration, Mr. DeLugoff notwithstanding, that club owners do have little preferences. You know, they do like certain musics. Other musics do get them a little nervous. You know, and they're not quite as objective as they'd like us to believe.
There is an emotional tie-in, in other words, between the club owner and the music that has made money for him. Not that he's really aesthetically sold on the music, but he becomes sold on it when the music makes money for him, you know.
I'd like to ask you something, because this is something that's preyed on my mind a long time, but I'm not a practicing musician. As a matter of fact, when you introduced us as jazz musicians, you have to include me out. But since I'm not a practicing musician, I'm not sure of this, but it seems to me that many of the club owners go around asking their favorite name musicians about certain of the more suspect types, you know, of musicians and composers. And, well, you can well imagine the kind of answers they get. And I do think, but I'm asking whether this is so, perhaps you know, that many fine musicians very often do lose out because some other person who happens to be in their good graces gives not necessarily a harsh opinion, but in some way indicates that, well, this isn't really the right thing for you. And of course, the two agree on this, and then it simply means that that musician is then eliminated from working.
I think this is true.
I know.
I don't want to name names. I could, but
well, it seemed to me that one of the biggest purposes of people misunderstanding certain things that exist in what is known as jazz or any type of music comes about by the things that people write or people tell them to hear or that their friends tell them, but it's still left up to the complete listener to make the man on his own mentality to understand anything that has come about for him to hear. But as far as the club owner, I don't think they will ever have the music of any particular period in the limelight as far as showing the people that this is happening or that is happening. If it wasn't for writers, I imagine people wouldn't even know who was playing a trombone or flute.
Well, I guess it's not particularly their function to do that. But I do feel they could be a little more open-minded and more perceptive. I mean, even if some of these club owners would once in a while read some of the more aware critics, I think it would help. I suppose this is a utopia which we can't expect from them, but
I just think they read a downbeat result.
Well, yes, that's it, right? Yes.
Well, as one club owner said to a person I know, he was shown the recent critics poll, and this friend of mine pointed to my name as a winner, and the owner said, well, is that the people's choice or is that the critic's choice?
Yeah, well, that sums it up, I think.
But do you think that the critic can also create a desire for the club owner to hire a group?
Oh, well, don't ask me, because it hasn't worked for me yet.
Much less you on that question.
Do you think so, Leroy?
Well, I didn't hear
that. Do you think the critic has any bearing on a club owner hiring a group? Do you think that a critic can create a desire for a club owner to hire a particular group that...
Not unless he can guarantee him a few dollars with it.
I see.
But just on the strength of him saying so, it's not...
Well, do you think that the educational purpose of what a critic does for the sake of people that have no knowledge what is going on in the music, help to cause the people to go out to a club to hear artists?
Well, that's hard to say. In some senses it does, but the people who really read critics are the critics who are knowledgeable critics are people who would be persuaded that a good thing was good anyway, just yes. by listening to it. The average fan reacts to the easiest music available.
But do you think critics go out and listen to music the way that they write about it?
Well, critics are as different as musicians. You know,
I don't think they do.
You've got separate. You've got different kinds of critics, just like you've got different kinds of musicians.
But do you think that regardless what type of critic you have, they should neglect the music regardless how if they are writing a liner note or listening at the music on a record? Do you think that is enough evidence for them to come to a conclusion of what's happening if they're not actually hearing it live?
Well, I know what you mean. Should they hear it live? But if you're reviewing a record, you're reviewing the record, you know, and the record should be artifact enough.
You think so? Although, I don't think so.
Well, I agree that the musician should be heard.
What about people that haven't been recorded?
Well, then the critic certainly won't be writing about him, usually.
And you mean the critic only writes about people that have recorded?
Usually that's true. Very seldom you write about. I remember I wrote an article about a blues singer in Newark, an old man named Mean William. And he hasn't been recorded, so they won't print
it. It would look like a critic would write about any facets of music that exists that had anything to do with what he believed in.
Well, I guess you can write about it, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be published.
I mean, you're saying a critic only writes what he gets paid for.
No, I'm saying that the critic writes what he wants to, but the publisher publishes also what he wants to. So there's a separation there that you might not understand.
Well, let's also admit that a large part of jazz exists primarily on recordings. I mean, I don't think there's any other music which exists so exclusively on records as jazz does. For instance, classical music exists primarily through live performances, and recordings of classical music are one-tenth of the recordings of jazz music.
No, but what I meant to Ornette is that I've had occasion to write pieces that have been edited, censored in some cases, especially on downbeat, is what I mean, on downbeat. Mm-hmm. And what you read there might not necessarily, to all intents and purposes, be what I started out to say. You know, they edit Don DeMichael, or whoever he has editing, they edit towards downbeat's editorial policies. I mean, that's a simple
fact. They do.
Of course they do. Frank Kofsky can tell you that. He wrote for them. Even Ralph Gleason can tell you that.
Oh, boy. Well, I think several things have been brought up here that, first of all, it seems as though critics aren't very dedicated people. I mean, there are certainly people who haven't been recorded that should be talked about. You know, I've been hearing about someone named Herbie Nichols for a long time. I never heard him, but I've been hearing that he's
recorded. Really,
so he's had two records, though, so that's why he's been talking about.
Well, there are probably other people that haven't. And then secondly, what is editorial policies now? That gets into...
Well, no, I'm just talking about... See, now, I just... I'm a poet. I just started writing about jazz because I like to write about jazz, you know. Uh-huh. But the point is, I discovered on Downbeat that in certain instances that there are... there is a kind of editing, but it's more like the editing towards a peculiar editorial stance rather than editing for, a more concise
Is it editing against a certain kind of music or music?
Well, yeah. Now, let me explain this one thing. I wrote an article on Ted Curzon recently, and in the article I mentioned some other trumpet players that I said were represented new wave trumpet players that I like, including Don Cherry and some other people like that. So this part of the sentence was taken out. Now, I didn't know this until I saw it in the magazine. The magazine will be out next week. These names were taken out, and substituted for this was the phrase, he is part of what you could call a new wave of jazz trumpeters, all of whom you might not like. You see what I mean? Which is a conscious, which to me seems to be a conscious attempt at taking it completely out of my hands, what I said, and saying something else.
Like apologizing for your statement.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that...
You music at all.
Well, no, I don't think that's the point.
But, we were heading for a certain point about whether... Ornette, you were asking whether the club owners would be influenced by a critic, and it hasn't been answered. I have one possible answer. It's been my observation that the club owners have been influenced by critics to this extent. If a critics or a bunch of critics have raved enough about a certain young new player, no matter how far out he may be, they will hire him for that one engagement, and they will present him as a novelty because they want to be the ones to have presented him, just like the critic wants to be the one to have discovered him. And they then will, you know, give him his 2 weeks, and thereby they've done their duty, and in very few cases do they hire those people back, and there are a couple sitting right at this table.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a case like that with a club owner asked me once about, I think Lucky Thompson was in town, and someone told him that Lucky Thompson was in town, and he asked me, should he hire Lucky Thompson? And I said, yeah, by all means, please hire him, you know, because he needs a job. But he didn't. Of course he didn't hire him.
Well, isn't it possible that if clubs are in business for, say, jazz music, there must be several clubs that have a policy of presenting any type of jazz under the heading of just if it can make money. But I thought that all the clubs in America had went into this policy of just hiring any well-knitted jazz group as long as the music was presentable enough to be played in a jazz club, as far as it not being new or old or any other facet of quality. But it seemed that the music has changed, but the clubs haven't changed.
I'd like to throw this in. Recently, I interviewed a club owner here in New York City, and he said that the artists are demanding money which he cannot pay because they cannot pay their way. In other words, if an artist, he wants $1,600 a week, he's got to be able to earn his way. He's got to earn his keep.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you an incident that happened to me. I've had three bands, and I might have another one day. But basically, that money problem has been one of the main reasons why I've had to keep changing bands, because if you have a guy in the band that has three or four kids, and those kids are like 2,000 or 3,000 miles away, and he's paying his family, food bill, and all those sorts of things, then he's got to pay the rent in this city. Then you got to convince him to move here, so a club owner can tell you that you can't work, and it gets to the point where that you become a social worker as well as a musician. And then you become such a social worker that the club owner tells you that, well, you can get along on this, because after all, you're here and you're here and you're doing that. But see, they have no idea that since a musician makes his a living, you know, like at night, as far as playing, like, you know, from dawn, from night to dawn, well, it takes quite a bit of money just to keep the quality of your existence to play the next night, in the sense of things that you have to have, like you might have to get clothes pressed when you could wait for them 2 or 3 days, and all sorts of things, especially if you're on the road. Well, club owners, they never think about the actually economical and tax life that you have to live as a citizen of the city. They just think of you as a musician. I don't think club owners think musicians are citizens.
Well, I don't think club owners think of musicians as musicians at all. I think club owners think of musicians as
commodities.
Exactly.
I had a club owner telling me, he asked me how much was I giving the sidemen when I was playing in this club, and I told him that I was giving them $250, and he told me, well, you know, you shouldn't have a band because you're paying your men too much money. But see, I had to play with those men, and if I could make those men as comfortable materialistically so that they could produce, then he would make more money and I would make more money. We all would make money. But he's telling me about, you know, I guess it's like saying, don't get a penny musician, you know, there's a half a penny musician around the street that do the same thing.
Well, his basic complaint was that the jazz musician doesn't know the economics of running a club.
Well, I think all that can get into a vicious circle, and there may be some truth, you know, in the fact. I mean, you'd have to sympathize with a little bit with a jazz club owner. They're not. Some of them aren't rich, and it gets into a bigger situation. And to me, I'd just like to ask why, when the last revolution in jazz was with Charlie Parker and Dizzy, and they weren't invited to panels to sit down and talk about why they didn't work or anything, and nobody really knows how much Charlie Parker had to go through before he was recognized. I think he was recognized a lot sooner and a lot quicker than what the people at this table who are characterized as being parts of a new revolution in jazz have. In other words, I think that the people around this table are having a much more difficult time of it as a group, you know, in getting work than Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker when they had a revolution, and they caused a revolution in jazz. And I wondered what your ideas were on that particular.
Well, would you say it's the basic economic structure, which does
not leave
it
completely.
Leave the doors open for this type of experimentation?
The only thing I would think is that the last movement in jazz was still a movement that was based on chord music with chords. In other words, it had a tie-in to Tin Pan Alley and to show business. Into all the shows, tunes like How High the Moon, and all those tunes, tunes coming out of shows out of Tin Pan Alley, where I think it was a much more accessible music than the kind of music that has caused a very valid evolution in jazz today. This music is not necessarily, it's a broader music. It's not based on changes or playing show tunes or pop tunes. Therefore, it's a less accessible music.
Would you say that the American public needs to be educated in this type of new jazz? By that, I mean by exposing them more by the vast
Of course. I mean, if the music was exposed, because the talk that has gone on has happened because Cecil Taylor has been recorded, Ornette Coleman has been recorded, Gunther Schuller has been recorded, I've been recorded, Don Ellis and Don Cherry and people have been recorded. Not recorded nearly enough, but
would you say
you're
not a commercial?
Pardon?
You're not a very good commercial venture then in the field of jazz? Record companies are sort of reluctant about pushing you? Or
no. I haven't had that experience with record companies. I've had it with, as far as, because in my particular instance, I bridged sort of two decades in jazz, so I began dealing with record companies in the 1940s, in the late 1940s, and all through, at least in the latter half of the 50s. And so I have some kind of voice on records, but at this time I know that Ornette has no voice on records, which is, and the same thing, I believe, for Cecil Taylor has no voice. And I think, you know, that is really a very ridiculous state of affairs, you know.
Well, would you have any positive recommendations? What do you think could open up the, I could toss it around to all you people, what do you think could open up this gate, break this barrier down?
Well, I think one thing, one idea is to perhaps take jazz out of the clubs.
Take it out of the clubs?
I think...
Why?
For reasons we've already discussed. I think there are other areas. For instance, I found one in Greenwich Village, Judson Church. They seem to be amenable to the idea of having music, not only jazz, but different kinds of things, activities going on there.
I would say you wouldn't have to take jazz out of the club, but there should maybe be say, if you had a string quartet in a jazz club, if more different types of jazz were given an opportunity, or more different types of music was given an opportunity to be performed, just because there was a building and you could make money from the performance of it, and that would be all, and everybody could make like they taste from it.
Yes, but you see, Ornette, that doesn't escape the reality of the club owners. The club owners are not going to put in a string quartet, they're not going to put in a string quartet and your group, or a string quartet and my group, because like we don't, you know, from that point of view, we're not financially.
I'm not speaking of the fact it have to be, you know, like they have to start with you or I or anyone. I'm just saying, I've read there are several different groups that are together. Like they had a recital of some guys at Justin Hall, I think they're called the Scientific Jazz Quintet or something. Anyway, I never heard them, but I imagine a club owner would never have them, you know.
Exactly. But, so why even go to club owners? Let's take it out of club owners. Let's perhaps look around for other areas where we can be heard.
But I think the club owners should find a way to, you know, govern.
They will. They will if we can show them that we can get people to come and hear us other places. Otherwise we're just beating a dead horse, because the club owners are commercial people. And they only want you if you're going to bring in a certain amount of people. And so what I'm really suggesting is that we start looking around for other sources for exposure. And I think people might come. You know, for instance, you say a program of a string quartet. Well, I would say that would be fine. But how about a program that would have Gunther's music, George Russell's music,
that's
and
exactly
your music,
what I mean.
My music. I think there would be an audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's take it to, these schools or something.
Sure, but the thing about that is that I once heard a person describe to me that the stages of listeners come like being born. Like, for instance, when you're 15, you listen to this. When you're 18, you're that. And when you're 19, you can, like, go out and find your broad, or broad and go find a guy, and then that means that you can take us somewhere. And there has been a lot of people that have never had the experience of, I guess, taking a person in a club. So that a girl have never had the experience of going in a club, or a bar never had the experience of going in a club. For instance, I have a kid, and I imagine 10 years or 15 years now, if he's still selling whiskey in clubs, he's going to really want to go in, you know? Mm. I mean, I know that's what happened to me. But I'm not saying that the music has got to be like it was when I was playing music. For instance, if there is a different type of music that is being played even after I have retired, and there are kids that still would like to go to clubs to hear it, if that music isn't being played in those clubs for those kids to hear, or either old people to hear, or even myself to hear, then it's still going to be the same problem.
Well, I would say that I had an experience last year. I played in a high school. It was not exactly a high school. The age of the group was from 8 to 16. And after the concert was over, these kids, and there were about 8 or 10 of them, came backstage. And they were from 8 to 16. And the perception of their questions was just astounding. They knew pretty much in their own language what had happened, what they'd been exposed to, and these kind of people, as George said, the quality of the music has changed. I also feel that there is reason to believe that the quality of the listener has changed, and that not necessarily will the listeners in the next generation think only of jazz music as something emanating from a club. I think they might think of it emanating in all kinds of places. And what I'm suggesting is, let's get together and take it to those places.
I would like to agree 1,000% with Cecil on this. I mean, if we admit, on the one hand, that that jazz has developed a long way from being a purely functional entertainment music, as it once perhaps was, or a dance music even, or all these other things that it was, a nightclub music, if it has become an art music, a music to be listened to, a music with a life of its own as music, then it has to be played in those places where that kind of art is accepted, and certainly the concert halls are one of the places. Unfortunately, as I see it, that certainly will give a certain status and a certain reception to this music. However, it does not solve all the economic problems. And the reason I say that is because I know from advanced classical music what a rough time that has. And actually what will happen, jazz will then be in a very similar position. I mean, advanced jazz will be in somewhat the same position as advanced classical music is. But at least it has its sort of artistic life and status, and it performs a definite artistic function that way, and that's the first thing, to preserve an art.
Well, yeah. Some of the best music I've heard in clubs, you know, since I first heard jazz and coming up, and I think that eventually the clubs will take on this new. They'll have to recognize this new evolution that's happening in jazz, and the people, whoever they are, that are part of it. I just have to get back to the thing of the last evolution being one in which the chord-based music was kept, and it was a marvelous revolution. I mean, the people in it were no less giants, but you still could go in and hear Ha Ha the Moon, no matter how.
Yes, but
how you heard it.
But was it always recognizable to the listener?
Well, that was the game. Yeah. The game was to the listener to say, "Oh, that's a line on Ha Ha the Moon," but at least he knew what it was a line on.
Well,
you know, or if he didn't,
do you think he was reacting to that, or do you think that he was, if he reacted at all, he was reacting to, like, what they did to?
Oh,
that.
At first, yeah.
The emotional and the important content of the music, because it seems to me, I worked with several old musicians, and they told me things like, well, when they first heard Bird and they heard Diz, they didn't know what was going on.
Right.
And it seemed to me that their reaction to those people was the same kind of reaction that we're getting today.
I think that that's true, because the first time that I heard Charlie Parker, I didn't know what was going on either. And it took Monk to around about midnight to get me into it. But as I began to see what was going on with the lines and the tunes they were based on, then it was a kind of a, I was easily educatable. And I think the people were more easily educatable concerning that particular kind of music because they still had something to relate to and to hold on to now.
But Judge, don't you feel that that people still have the same thing? It's just the sound of the music.
Mm-hmm.
And the tensions and everything have changed. The same things that have affected the music have also affected the people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That the nature of man has changed. It's always changed.
Yeah, but Cecil, I'd like to agree with that. Because then, you know, it would be, I think, a much happier world.
You're talking about the highest level of listener.
But no, only thing I'm saying is that I think we have to recognize it as jazz people, or as artists in music, that we have a very small audience. And I'm not so sure that the actual percentage of that audience has diminished.
Well, it's true.
You know,
it's
in
true.
Comparison to eras.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it is true that the... jazz music has supported the working class people longer than classical music has. Classical music has been for the non-working class person, and jazz music has gotten to the reality where that the working class, are either the non-working class, can derive something from it. And
what do you mean by working class and non-working class?
Well, I have. I met a guy the other day that told me he had his first job when he was 30 years old.
And he's what? He's a non-working
class? He was up until 30 years old. He was an unworking person.
And this kind of person is
has,
what?
I think that type of person has music affect them different from a working class person.
You think that people who don't work don't go to the Metropolitan Opera?
No, I
mean, you think that people who work don't go to the Metropolitan Opera?
Yes,
I disagree with that. I see.
I mean, I think they do. I think they do, but I don't think it's the same people. I don't think it's as many of those people go as the ones that doesn't work. For instance, if you, just like you were speaking about music being in a point where people couldn't understand it, well, I know if you, say, would go to the Bowery or something and you're playing blues, regardless, you would, almost 90% of your audience would be working type people that would understand that.
Working type on the Bowery?
Yeah, yeah, and because these are gay. Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because I don't think that what has been known as like the blues and jazz, that has really come out of the working type of person. I haven't. I'm not saying that people that haven't got a background for working are like have no knowledge of what's going on in that sense, but I have found that that does exist. I mean, it exists to the point where that you can't. Sometimes I have met people that I couldn't even talk to because they ask me questions that you know that hasn't anything to do with what I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. But it's very good sociable conversation.
Mm-hmm. I think what Arnett has said made me think of something else. I think one of the problems is. And I'd like to ask you how you feel about this. I think one of the problems is that jazz has become separated from its audience. I'm not too sure that the people, for instance, who come to the Village Gate and other clubs in the area are necessarily the only audience that, or the most receptive audiences. I think, I've been played in clubs in very low economic surroundings. And the people in these clubs were working class people in the lower of the lower economic realm. And each night, cats would come from all over the city to play at the Paradise Club, for instance. And this went on night after night. And these people would be drinking and talking, and all of a sudden, the cats would be playing, and they'd turn around and say, "Yeah." And I, as a musician, would say, "Yeah, too." Now, these people had, in many cases, no formal education, no, and certainly no musical education, but somehow we both felt the same thing at the same time. And the point I'm trying to make is that I believe that in many ways, jazz has become separated from its most receptive audiences. You know, and what we're, of course, what we're confronted with is the problem of, well, the club owner who feels that he won't give us exposure, you see. And so it goes back to the other thing. I think we must go in other areas and expose ourselves.
Well, you talk about jazz and the working people, and do any of you all have any experiences of I suppose the number one area in New York that contains working people on the lower economic rung would be Harlem. Are any of your records on the jukebox in Harlem, Arnett?
I've never heard them.
Well, I'd like to say something maybe more discursive than necessary, mm-hmm. but you're talking about the revolution in the 40s. I think it was. Mm-hmm. It's as much a social revolution as a musical one.
Mm-hmm.
In terms that Parker and Monk and those people were suddenly didn't have to think of themselves as performers anymore, mm-hmm. but musicians, which created an automatic separation from swing conscious American public, and most of you musicians now, in a sense, it's as much a social cleavage between what you mm-hmm. know. A person can listen to say. Art Blakey's music, or can listen to the Jazz Tet with, and be much more casual about it than, say, listening to anybody's music here. Mm-hmm. And this necessity to listen harder also, you know, separates a great part of the American public. Now, the average American doesn't know about any jazz, not only new jazz, mm-hmm. but he doesn't know about any kind of jazz, not even blues. And what he was talking about mm-hmm. working class, you'd be surprised that if Ornette plays a blues, like a, you know, a mm-hmm. basic blues, it is, it connects with people
yeah.
in mm-hmm. Harlem. I mean, mm-hmm. no matter, but it might not connect with, say, a critic on Downbeat. Just as in John Coltrane plays can play a popular song like My Favorite Things, and it's one thing. Mm-hmm. But if he plays like a basic blues like that Chasing the Train, then you get a lot. Then you get a lot of comment. You see.
Well, do you you think then that the audience for Charlie Parker at the time was predominantly a Negro audience, and that
well,
the Negro bourgeoisie accepted Charlie
no,
Parker?
No, no, the bourgeoisie, of course, no, because the bourgeois are the same as white Americans. There's no difference. You haven't made a difference. But I will say this, where I lived, mm-hmm. although I'm the son of a, you know, heavy bourgeois family,
yeah.
still where I lived, when Charlie Parker, when Bird's music came on, when it came out, mm-hmm. there were people popping their fingers throughout the blackest slums in Newark. And I know now that what somebody says, what Ira Gitlis says about you know, like Ornette, or what he says about Coltrane, means absolutely nothing to, say, the young Negroes I know in Harlem, or even mm-hmm. who live down here, or in the Lower East Side. Mm-hmm. No, they realize that no one can tell you when to pop your fingers, you know. And it's a simpler idea. It's simply that the clubs, as Cecil says, caters to a specific economic class.
That gets into
not
a curious
can
thing,
pay
Leroy.
$2.50 to go to a club.
It gets into a very curious thing, because even though I would think that Coltrane should make an impact in any place in America on a Negro audience, since Negroes are to me the innovators in jazz, and that is up till now they've been the chief innovators in jazz, and every important movement has come from the Negro. However, you will get very strange things happening, like, for instance, in Kansas City, you'll get Coltrane going into a club and the audience being night after night predominantly a white audience,
mm-hmm.
and where Coltrane is absolutely just about rejected by the Negro populace. On the other hand, you can get another group in there, a more down-home group, and you get the reverse type of situation, you know?
No, but what I mean is that it is, in some sense, a continuum, where you can get Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf to go down to Kansas City and tear the place up, sure. You can get, say, a very slick modern group like, say, Cannonball's group to go down there. And they'll get, say, a middle-class, college-going Negro audience who'll eat that up. You see what I mean? But now, see, all the ballyhoo about John Coltrane, all the people saying how far out John Coltrane is, and also the economic idea that not all people can afford to pay $2.50, whether they want to see John Coltrane or not. And I'm sure in Kansas City, there are fewer Negroes with $2.50 than there are whites, so that accounts for the audience to a great extent.
I think the Negro audience is just as capable of being brainwashed and being,
of course, more so.
You know, as the whole problem gets down as the white majority in this country, the whole problem gets down to this machine that keeps brainwashing all the people.
Everything.
You know.
Well, the point I want to make about Ornette and what you were saying about the revolution before is that, when this happened, when these people, when suddenly Charlie Parker started walking around and living with painters and things, and by their stance as musicians, like erasing the whole idea of the performer, you know, of being the burlesque music hall or, you know, performer, you get an automatic separation from say, the black middle class, and of course from the white middle class. And even today, now, when I know Ornette, and I know Cecil, you know, like in terms of as you know, a friendly a basis, and I, you know, a poet. It's an automatic separation, and it's a kind of separation certainly critics won't realize, because they don't want to accept jazz as an art, because they think it is a pretension rather than the natural development of you know, a music based on Western social terms. I mean, these people are You're all musicians, artists, not necessarily performers. And to go into like the five spot and expect Joe Termini to recognize you as being artists is absurd. I mean, you know, ambitious bartenders have nothing to do with art.
This is a classic question that has been handled by disc jockeys on the radio and various jazz columns. Concerning the recent tour of Benny Goodman to the Soviet Union under the sponsorship of the State Department, I'd like to toss this around to each person here at this table and give comment about it if you possibly can.
Well, I think these things are solved in the cocktail bars around Madison Avenue, you know. And, of course, it's ridiculous to me. This man hasn't been active in jazz in quite a while, and he has, from what I understand, some very bigoted attitudes about jazz anyway. And why Duke Ellington wasn't sent, it can go back to the whole thing of this desperate urge of everybody, and this is what frightens me, that everybody in the country is desperately trying to achieve mediocrity, you know. And so the best wasn't sent, some mediocre entity was sent, and even the Russian people, I've corresponded with some Russian students about it, and they wonder why Ellington wasn't sent.
Gunther?
Well, I don't know that I add much to that. That says about all that can be said. I of course agree that there are not only Ellington but several other famous Negro musicians that should have been sent. But I think what we're dealing with here is the same old huge gap between the realities of music as it exists for us and as it exists for the American public. I mean, I think that the people who made this decision, whether it was in Madison Avenue or in Washington, D.C., those people figured, well, the king of swing is still it, you know, even though this is a music that we know to be 20 years dead at least. And in the public image, in the American public image, and then they superimposed that on the Russian public image, Benny Goodman is still the much stronger attraction, much stronger name than Duke Ellington. I mean, this is almost, the words hardly, I can hardly get the words out of my mouth, but that seems to be the truth. And that's what we're up against. I mean, that sort of sums up, that it relates very well to the basic problem we've been discussing.
Arnett?
Well, I think one of the basic problems concerning all the misunderstanding of why Duke Ellington didn't go to Russia is basically because of the music and not Benny Goodman. To me, if whoever had the privilege or the money to send Benny Goodman and was representing what is known as jazz music, if they had the money to buy the best or had the money to put together whatever jazz music could be played for people to listen to, I certainly think it should have been Duke Ellington as far as music is concerned, because I really love to hear composed music by people that have been innovators of the music that we play, that is jazz. To me, Benny Goodman is not a say composed musician like Duke Ellington, and Duke Ellington could have did more for the music, more than just to sell the music for people to listen to.
Cecil?
Well, I think the basic question is one of reality. I can understand why Goodman was chosen, because I don't think his choice had anything to do with his artistic worth. I think that was, or if his artistic worth had anything to do with it, I think that was only one of the considerations. I think there are social and political implications in his choice, as well as economic. Has nothing to do with the rightness of the situation, but we're not talking about right here. We're talking about a political reality, and you know, there's no question in my mind that there are other people more qualified. But you see, it's all in a sense tied up with like what we're facing in the clubs. You know, we have to try to make them see our reality.
Well, it seemed that was just somebody's terrible error, because even politically, it would seem it'd be better to send a Negro, so it would be.
That's what I was going to say.
You know, so they could say, you know, it seemed that everything is equal over here. That was, well, somebody's terrible error.
What do you see?
They just made a terrible mistake.
But didn't that sort of? I think they thought of that, but then they figured, well, the Russians would
obvious.
Say, yeah, it'd be too obvious, you know.
About Benny Goodman, I think it was just an error on somebody's part. Somebody didn't even know enough about jazz to get something that would be even passable, because Benny Goodman couldn't get by. It's like several newspapers hiring jazz columnists who don't know anything about jazz at all. For instance, The Post is getting Jerry Talmer as their jazz critic. Now, he might be a passable drama critic, but he certainly doesn't know anything about jazz. But it's just that they feel they can just sort of dump it in with the entertainment thing.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, some of the people who were consulted on this Russian tour of Benny Goodman's were in the Hurok office, or perhaps Hurok himself. I'm sure that he was asked about this, because the thing was kind of worked out in some kind of exchange way too, you know, Russian artists being sent here and so on. And of course the greatest practitioner of this racket is Hurok, and he was definitely consulted, and there's a man who knows absolutely zero about jazz. He has great business acumen, and so business was the deciding factor here rather than what's right musically.
That's true with jazz all the time, though. You find it's the only business, and people try to make it a big business, where the entrepreneur, the businessman, has absolutely no knowledge about his product. That's why the jazz gallery folded. They should have a marketing report, or a little marketing bulletin put out for these jazz club owners, so they could find out about their own product. It's just a matter of them being completely not having any knowledge about the music at all, and caring less about it. You know, jazz clubs, they want to sell liquor. They don't want people to hear music.
But do you think that there are, say, the managers or bookers of their performance have anything to do with any weight, carry any weight with the club owners, as far as you think that if Benny Goodman had a, say, maybe a hipper manager, someone that felt that he wasn't able to foot the bill and would tell him to recommend someone else?
Oh,
you think that's
happening? He's paying his salary. The way he would take money out of his bank.
In other words, that it's
oh, man, you're out of sight.
No. A job is a job.
well, that's exactly why we will never know why Duke Ellington didn't go.
Well, I'd like to say something. Do you think that what's called the way out is more acceptable to one group of people than to any other group? Or do you think the way out is equally assailed by all groups of people who don't understand them? Understand the music, or the poetry, or the art, or whatever.
I think Webb has taken on the same image the Beatnik took. Because I remember one day I was walking the street, and this little kid, I had a beard, and this little kid looked up at me and started pointing and said, "There's one."
There's one.
You know, so I mean, whatever I was.
In relation to that, I heard a very interesting comment made by a very fine composer out in the West Coast. He works in the Hollywood studios, but he's one of the better and more honest musicians out there. And this was in connection with the Ojai Festival, at which Eric Dolphy played. And this, at a sort of a party afterwards, this whole discussion of whether some of the far-out musicians were to be considered in the realm of beatniks came up, you know. And this guy popped up and says, "Well, anybody who plays above a high C on a bass clarinet must be considered a beatnik or a subversive, you know."
Well, you so remember, that's what you they remember think. When they used to say bebopper and bopper the same way they said beatnik? And remember, the bopper jokes came before the beatnik jokes.
Yes. Well, do you think there is such a thing as the word "way out" having some actually materialistic meaning? I mean, does it really exist?
The term "way out"?
I mean,
it's having any meaning in its own way.
Yeah.
As being out from tradition, yes.
For instance, like Gunther's record, Abstraction, and I would consider that in the sense of way out only in the aspects of what was being tried, what was being played, what was being tried, what was being created as far as the elements of music being exploited to the...
At that time.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I said. It's way out. It's an accurate term in terms of tradition, you know. It is way out in terms of what's traditionally
done. Those Russians went up in space, they are way out.
That's true. But in the sense of it, it's also realistic. It's a realistic expression of our times. But I just used...
Do you think that people could conceive what way out is in the sense of comparing those Russians being actually off the earth as being things that are being dead on the earth that have the same meaning as that, as far as music?
Well, I think that's a very profound question, mm-hmm. and it's certainly affecting the way people think today, and it might be one thing that'll be in favor of them accepting.
Because I hate to go out there and play.
Well, you'll be in first with your Stratus one, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, they won't be way out next week, maybe, because it'll go even further next week.
No, but
no, you know what I'm trying to say? I'm saying that the fact that we're in a contest in space, you know, which is a very exciting thing these times, forces people to tighten up and to get off of this old traditional bandwagon of putting everything down that's new. They are going to have to really...
But you know, George, people have a built-in rationalizer which separates art, you know, from the material things in the world. Now, that spacecraft up there is a material thing, and it has to do with, concrete things and inventions, even war. It has to do with things which people easily understand. But when you're talking in terms of way out music, that's such a vague thing to them, and it's not a necessity to them, you know. I think lots of Americans feel that this, you know, race to the moon is an absolute necessity in our lives. Music is not. It's something they can take or leave.
What people you're talking about, Cecil brought up some people who are very sensitive now to these things. I imagine the younger people, their sensitivities are keyed up pretty highly, and they would be much more receptive to what's going on artistically, you know, than...
But I think the proportion is always the same, and I think there is this... that we're talking about a minority.
You don't think Americans feel a sense of urgency about their education and their general status as people?
I wish I could just say yes to that. I think the education, the way the education thing has been pushed now, yes, you're right. But you know, there have been cases before where nations have not awakened in time.
Yes,
let's face it. And the thing is that to the extent that there has been a re-emphasis of the educational process in this country, It's been there only insofar as it's been geared to technological things. I mean, has it been geared to the arts as much as it has been to science and mathematics? The whole emphasis, suddenly, you know, everybody's hip to this one thing. But that's not enough. So I'm still very pessimistic about that.
That's one question I like to throw at you people. Recently, here at WBAI, one of the participants was asked a question: why isn't there any major Negro jazz critics in the field? And no one was able to answer it.
Well, that seems to me one of the simplest questions in the world. The way jazz has developed and the way this country has developed, the only Negroes who, say, would be capable of becoming critics, just like the only Negroes who at one time were capable of becoming writers or painters, were from the middle class. And for the middle class, jazz was not something that could help them become fully integrated into American society, so they didn't go into it. It's only recently that a few Negroes who, who are involved in what's called the arts, or who have benefited by liberal American educations, have started to think about jazz as being significant enough to devote one's life to it on another level than the instinctive one of playing it. There are now, I guess, a couple of Negro A&R men, Tom Wilson, Beat Savoy, and Esmond Edwards of Prestige. And there is a couple of Negroes who do write on jazz. Certainly the novelist Ralph Ellison has been writing some very fascinating things on jazz. In the Saturday Review, he just wrote something on Bird recently that was good. But it's just it has been the fact that the Negro, the bourgeois, was didn't want to get involved with anything that was in the least bit Negro. Mm. And it's only recently that there has been. I write on jazz not as a jazz critic, but simply because the music is important to me, and I feel I have something to say about it. And it, it certainly, if I disagree with what some other people are saying and think that I can say it better, that's one of the reasons I do it. But still, even now, economically, you run into the same thing. I mean, commercially, where most white jazz critics, have gone at it in the sense of making a living by doing that, and there are still only a few Negroes who would be interested in making a living by writing about jazz. You know.
Well, I should hope to see the time when, and everything in America becomes truly integrated, and certainly jazz criticism. I just deplore the state of jazz criticism in general in this country. It's really a myth, you know. Mm.
Well, it's a difficult, it's a hard thing to envision, because the only respected kind of criticism there is criticism about writing, literary criticism, and that's because that is a form of writing. Mm-hmm. The literary critic is judged as a writer, just like the writer is, and they're very good, beautiful stylists as literary critics. The art critics are a disreputable bunch. Music critics are a disreputable bunch, mm-hmm. simply because what they do does not have to do initially with the art they're trying to inform you
is
about.
Is it affected any by the fact that you make $4 a review on Downbeat?
How do you mean? About why it's so bad?
Critics are on Downbeat, I understand, are paid $4 a review.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's true.
I don't see how you could really make much of a... It's sort of a scroungy living, isn't it? I mean, you have to...
Well, I think that the people who do it, that most of those critics have, on Downbeat, have a lot of other things going. They don't depend on that $4. You can do that. I mean, they have columns in different places, A&R work.
What I never could understand is how a person could put a record down and write about it at the same time. You know, because the critics write all the latter notes and then they put it down.
The way you said it before, I thought was better. How you could take the time to write about it if you didn't like it. That's a good point.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Well, I find that I can write about something like that if somebody else is making a big thing about it. I know musicians who are supposed to be great that I take great pleasure in jumping on. Or musicians who are making, very rich musicians, for instance, selling a lot of records. I take pleasure in beating up on them because of that, because I think it's a law, their popularity.
Do you think anybody could become wealthy and still maintain some integrity in what they're doing?
Well, Christ said that about passing through the camel, passing through the eye of a needle.
Do you feel that way about a critic?
Well,
do you think a critic can get rich by living to what he believes?
I think it could happen, sure, but it would have to.
Do you know any that actually are doing it?
To a certain extent, sure. I think. Well, the critics that I like best, I'd say, are Martin Williams and Hentoff, Nat Hentoff, for different reasons, certainly. Mm-hmm. But I think they more or less say what they mean.
But don't you think that a critic? Ambition is to weigh the weight of his work, whether it's
materialistically or financially as far as he can in the relationship of the work that he's doing? I mean, would you, if it happened that that the public would all of a sudden realize that this critic is actually telling them something, and the literary people start giving him more money, and he finds out that they're really enjoying what he's saying, and he finds himself rich, do you think he would start lying?
Well, I don't know. Gee, I don't know. I'm sure that if it meant, if he had to lie probably to keep that money,
yeah.
Then possibly he would do it, you know. And I know a whole lot of jazz musicians who do the same thing, who play the same way, and then when they find out it's successful, they start imitating themselves.
Yeah,
sure.
I think that.
You know, painters, writers, they all do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the point is, I don't think the money has necessarily to do with it, but what you had to do to get it.
Oh, I see, yeah.
You know, because nobody will give you anything for just telling the truth unless, you know, that truth is available commercially.
Mm-hmm. Well, a critic has more of a responsibility than to just write what he feels, I think. That's being a reviewer. Just giving your personal opinion, don't you think a critic should be objective and be able to place the music in, you know, its proper perspective?
Yeah, well, I think so, sure. Mm-hmm. But Ornette was talking about lying, though, and I think that's a different thing. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the reason why I have noticed that throughout the generation of successful jazz composers, our jazz players, if they've, you know, gotten successful financially, they, critics don't take as much interest in them as they have, and it ends up, you can hear it in their playing. I remember one saxophone player told me once that he says, well, you know, the critics say, I've had it, so you're the king now, and, you know, you take it from there. And I was just thinking, you know, maybe he got in this way because he thought the critics were thinking he was making too much money, you know, and so that's why his reality of what he was doing actually meant that, you know, because he actually believed what they were saying, you know. And later, you know, like he found out that they were just full of, you know, whatever that is. And his conception of what he was doing didn't matter. It only meant what he put in and what he got out of it. And now they write back saying that he's still great. That's great, you know?
But there are very few, but it's strange that there are very few good jazz musicians who are rich, though.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really funny.